Historical What Ifs. Historical What Ifs.
History hinges on moments so small they could fit in the palm of your hand. Yet their consequences echo through centuries and shape the world we live in today. This is Historical What Ifs, where we explore the alternate timelines that could have emerged from a single different decision, a missed opportunity, or a stroke of luck that went the other way. Today's episode examines one of those pivotal moments and traces the extraordinary chain of events that might have followed if history had taken just one small turn in a different direction. Welcome to Historical What Ifs, reimagining pivotal moments. Historical What Ifs.
Today, we're diving into a scenario that is, frankly, almost impossible to fully comprehend. It's a change so fundamental, it rewrites the DNA of the Western and Middle Eastern worlds as we know them.
The question we're posing is this: what if the Crusades, that 200-year-long series of religious wars that defined the High Middle Ages, simply never happened?
It's a massive question. And I have to admit, this one is personal for me. My fascination with history really began with the sheer epic scale of the Crusades. The clash of civilizations, the politics, the technology. It was the ultimate historical drama. Imagining its absence feels like removing the central conflict from a story.
That's exactly how I see it, but from a screenwriter's perspective. The Crusades are this grand, terrible, sprawling narrative that gave us everything from the Knights Templar to Richard the Lionheart. It shaped our archetypes of heroes and villains for 1,000 years. For me, the question isn't just what changes politically, but what stories do we lose? And more importantly, what new stories, what different kinds of heroes emerge in their place?
Precisely. Because it's not just about preventing a few battles. It's about the entire trajectory of papal power, the fate of the Byzantine Empire, the flow of trade and knowledge between East and West, and the very identity of both Christendom and the Islamic world, which were forged in the crucible of this conflict.
So, prepare yourselves. We're about to step off the established path of history into a world where the call of Pope Urban II falls on deaf ears, where Deus Vult is never cried, and where Jerusalem is not a prize to be won by the sword.
The ramifications are staggering, and we're going to explore every ripple, every butterfly effect to construct this alternate timeline. A Middle Ages without its defining holy war.
So let's start at the very beginning of that ripple, the ground zero of this whole scenario. It's not actually in Rome with Pope Urban. It's in Constantinople with the Byzantine Emperor Alexios I Komnenos.
Right. He's the one who sends envoys to the Council of Piacenza in 1095. And he's not asking for a holy war to reclaim Jerusalem. He's asking for mercenaries.
He's asking for a few hundred well-trained, heavily armored Western knights to help him push back the Seljuk Turks, who're practically knocking on his door. They've taken over almost all of Anatolia, which was the heartland of the empire.
And in our history, he gets this monstrous, uncontrollable response he never anticipated. But in this new timeline, Pope Urban's speech at Clermont, it just doesn't land. Maybe the political climate in France is different. Maybe he phrases it differently. Whatever the reason, it's a dud.
So, what does Alexios do? He's still desperate. The Seljuks are still there. Does he get anything? A handful of soldiers for hire?
I think that's the best case scenario. He gets a few hundred knights, maybe 1,000, who are in it for the money, not for God. They're manageable. They do a job, they get paid, they go home. There is no massive armed pilgrimage carving a path of destruction across his empire to get to the Holy Land.
And that alone is a huge change. He doesn't have to deal with the logistical nightmare of tens of thousands of armed zealots showing up, demanding food, and wanting to swear oaths of fealty that they're probably going to break.
He doesn't lose control of the narrative, which is exactly what happened in our timeline. He wanted a scalpel. he got a sledgehammer that smashed his own house on the way to the target. So, without that sledgehammer, Byzantium is... what?
I think it has to be. Initially, anyway. They don't have to waste resources managing, fighting, and then ultimately competing with the Crusader states. They can focus entirely on their primary threat, the Seljuks in Anatolia.
So does he retake Anatolia? With a few mercenaries and his own forces? Can he actually push them back?
That's the million-dollar question. I'm skeptical he could manage a full reconquest. The damage was too severe. But he could certainly secure his western coastlines, maybe push them back from Nicaea. What he would do, what the Byzantines always did best, is turn to diplomacy.
Ah, so you're saying instead of this grand clash of civilizations, we get a much murkier, politically complex situation.
Precisely. The great Seljuk Empire was already starting to fracture at this point. You had rival claimants, ambitious regional governors, a lot of internal strife. The First Crusade, ironically, might have given them a common enemy to rally against, at least for a while.
Wait. So are you suggesting that the absence of the Crusades could lead to the Seljuk state collapsing faster?
It's a very real possibility. Without the external pressure from the Franks, those internal fault lines would be much wider. Alexios would be pouring money and spies into the Seljuk court, propping up one claimant against another, keeping them weak and divided. It's classic Byzantine foreign policy.
So, the entire map of the Middle East looks different. You don't get the Kingdom of Jerusalem, the County of Edessa, Antioch, these Frankish outposts. Instead, you get a weakened but surviving Byzantine Empire playing a Game of Thrones with a mosaic of competing Turkish successor states in Anatolia and Syria.
And think about the other major player in the region, the Fatimid Caliphate in Egypt. They were Shia Muslims and bitter rivals of the Sunni Seljuks. In our timeline, they initially even tried to ally with the Crusaders against the Seljuks.
Oh, of course. Until they realized the Crusaders were just as happy to take Jerusalem from them. So without the Crusaders as this chaotic third party, does the Fatimid-Seljuk rivalry become the main event? A two-way Cold War for control of the Levant?
It would have to be. That becomes the central conflict of the 12th century Middle East. And Jerusalem, it remains a prize, but it's a prize in an intra-Muslim conflict. It's not this symbol for an entire other civilization from across the sea.
Wow. The entire religious and cultural temperature is just lower. It's not about holy war anymore. It's just about power, politics, the same old story, but without that fanatical, world-altering edge.
But that lower temperature, that lack of a fanatical edge, that has to have a massive blowback effect in Europe, right? We've been talking about Byzantium and the Seljuks, but the papacy just invented this incredible tool for projecting power, the Crusade. If that tool never gets invented, what happens to the Pope?
That is the other shoe dropping, isn't it? The Crusades, more than anything, cemented the Pope as the leader of Western Christendom. Not just a spiritual leader, but a political and military one. He could snap his fingers and, in theory, direct the armies of kings.
He could point at an enemy, any enemy, and say, go. And they would. Without that is the great medieval power struggle between the papacy and the Holy Roman emperors, even a real contest.
I think it gets profoundly lopsided. The emperor has the armies. In our timeline, the Pope has the moral authority, backed by this ultimate weapon of mass mobilization. But in this alternate world, when the Pope gets into a feud with the Emperor, what can he do? Excommunicate him? The Emperor might just shrug.
So the dream of a papal monarchy, of the Pope as the arbiter of all Christian rulers,
that just withers on the vine.
It has to. The Pope remains an incredibly important figure, but he's a bishop. The Bishop of Rome. He's not the commander-in-chief of God's army, because there is no God's army.
Wow. But okay, If you take that central conflict away, you're also taking away the primary release valve for European violence. All those Lamless second and third sons, the ultra-violent knightly class, they were exported, sent east.
Yes, they were. A whole generation of restless, ambitious, and frankly dangerous men were given a target thousands of miles away. What happens when they all stay home?
Oh, that's not a good thought. They don't go to Antioch. They stay in Anjou. They're not carving out a kingdom in Jerusalem. They're trying to carve one out of their neighbor's lands in Tuscany or Saxony.
Does Europe just turn on itself? Do we see a century of even more brutal, more constant internal warfare? Kings and dukes would have this permanent, simmering threat of a warrior class with nothing to do but cause trouble for them.
So, the process of state building could get much, much bloodier. A king isn't just fighting other kings. He's constantly trying to suppress his own barons, who are chomping at the bit for a war. Any war.
Or, here's another thought. Does it accelerate state building? Maybe kings are forced to develop stronger central authorities, more sophisticated legal systems, specifically to tame these guys. They can't just send them on crusade, so they have to actually govern them.
That's a fascinating paradox. The lack of a foreign war forces the creation of a more stable domestic order. But what about the wars that were already happening? The Reconquista in Spain, for instance. That was framed as a crusade.
And that's a key point. Without the idea of crusading, is it still the Reconquista? Or is it just the Spanish Wars? It loses that international pan-Christian character. You don't get knights from France and England flocking to Iberia to fight for the cause.
It becomes a local conflict, a series of territorial expansions by the kingdoms of Castile, Aragon, and Portugal. It's not a grand narrative of Christendom reclaiming lost lands.
Exactly. The very concept of Christendom as a unified militant bloc, it might never fully form. That identity was forged in the fires of the Holy War. Without the war, you just have a collection of disparate kingdoms who happen to share a faith. The entire psychology of medieval Europe is different.
And that psychology, that's the part that really gets me. If you don't have Christendom versus the Islamic world, does that mean Europe is more tolerant? Or is it just that the other is no longer thousands of miles away, but is now just the guy in the next duchy who speaks a slightly different dialect?
I think it has to be the latter. It's not that the intolerance vanishes. It hyper-localizes. The grand unifying external enemy is gone. So all that aggressive energy we talked about, the knightly class with nothing to do, it gets focused inward, but without the religious justification that at least pretended to unite everyone.
So a war between France and the Holy Roman Empire isn't just a political squabble anymore. It's almost a clash of civilizations in miniature. There's no higher calling to appeal to. No pope can say, "Stop fighting each other, we have a common foe in the East."
There is no common foe in the East. And that brings up something else. For all the bloodshed, the Crusades created this incredible, violent, intimate channel of communication between two worlds.
Yes, the flow of goods, of technology, of ideas. We think of it as a clash. But it was also the most profound point of contact since the Roman Empire.
Profound is the right word. Think about what came west. We're not just talking about spices and silks. We're talking about knowledge that had been lost to Europe for centuries. The works of Aristotle, of Plato, of Galen, they were preserved and studied in Baghdad, in Damascus, in Cordoba.
They were translated from Greek to Arabic, commented on, expanded upon, and then through places like the Crusader States, Sicily, and Spain, they were translated from Arabic into Latin, and reintroduced to a Europe that had, well, that had largely forgotten them.
So without that big bloody catalyst, does that transmission slow to a crawl? Does the intellectual flowering of the 12th and 13th centuries just not happen?
That's a terrifying thought. I mean, the entire foundation of scholasticism, of thinkers like Thomas Aquinas, trying to synthesize Aristotelian logic with Christian theology. Does that whole project get delayed by a century? 2 centuries? Does it happen at all if they don't get that sudden massive data dump of classical philosophy?
The transfer would still happen, I think, but in a completely different way. It wouldn't be a flood. It would be a trickle. It would come through merchants in Sicily, through scholars on the Spanish frontier. But it wouldn't have that urgency, that continent-wide impact. It wouldn't be part of this grand, shared experience.
So the Renaissance, if it comes, it's a much more muted affair. It's not this explosion of rediscovery. It's a slow, piecemeal reassembly of lost knowledge. Wow. But what about the stuff that wasn't just preserved, but was innovated? I'm thinking of the tangible things.
Like medicine? Or mathematics?
Exactly. Mathematics. Things we take completely for granted. Arabic numerals, the concept of zero, algebra. These were revolutionary tools for commerce, for architecture, for everything.
Oh, the economic impact of that is, it's almost impossible to calculate. European merchants were still fumbling with Roman numerals. Try doing long division with M's and C's and X's. It's a nightmare. The system actively holds back complex finance.
So if the adoption of that superior system is delayed because the primary point of contact is gone, does that hamstring the growth of the Italian city-states? Do the great banking houses of Florence and Venice even rise in the same way?
You're not just losing a war. You're losing a technological upgrade for an entire civilization. The lack of crusades doesn't just make Europe more provincial psychologically. It might keep it more provincial technologically for a much, much longer time. The entire engine of European commerce could be running at half speed.
And that's the thing, isn't it? Half speed feels like an understatement. It's like the entire operating system of a civilization is running on a slower processor. The very tools for growth, financial, intellectual, architectural, are blunted.
They are. And this technologically slower, more provincial Europe, think about what that means for the future. The entire age of discovery is predicated on a Europe that is, by the 1400s, wealthy enough, ambitious enough, and technologically capable enough to start pushing out into the Atlantic.
The impetus is different, too. So much of that push was about outflanking the Ottoman and Mamluk control of the eastern trade routes. Trade routes that were supercharged by the Crusades in the first place. If Venice and Genoa aren't these hyper-rich maritime powers built on that trade, is the motivation even there?
Do they even have the ships? Or the navigational science? Or the capital to fund a voyage for a madman like Columbus? Maybe that whole era of European expansion gets postponed indefinitely.
So the entire global balance of power for the next 500 years is redrawn. Or, rather, it's never drawn in the first place. But there's a darker side to that inward-looking Europe we talked about. All that violence, all that othering energy, has to go somewhere.
And it often went to the most convenient internal other. We can't forget that the first massacres of the First Crusade didn't happen in Anatolia or Syria. They happened in the Rhineland. The Jewish communities of Speyer, Worms, and Mainz were annihilated by crusaders on their way east.
It's a horrifying thought, but in a world without the concept of a crusade, does that specific brand of religiously sanctioned anti-Semitism ever reach that fever pitch? Or does that nightly violence just find them anyway, under a different pretext?
That's one of those questions that's almost impossible to answer. And it's deeply unsettling either way. The hatred was there, but the Crusades gave it a license and a divine mission. Without that mission, maybe it remains a more latent, localized poison instead of a continental contagion.
So when we finally step back and look at the two timelines we've sketched out, it's just staggering. Our history is one of violent, convulsive, but rapid change. A terrible, bloody catalyst that forced two worlds together, and in doing so, accelerated the development of both, for good and for ill.
It truly is. And this alternate world is, what? it's not necessarily a utopia. It's a world of more fractured, persistent, lower-level conflicts. A world where the Byzantine Empire might survive longer, but Europe remains a technological backwater for centuries. A world without the sublime poetry of Rumi, who fled the Mongol invasions that followed the chaos of the Crusader era. But also a world without the burning of libraries.
It's a trade-off, isn't it? We lose the grand, terrible narrative. We lose the archetypes of the Lionheart and Saladin. We lose the architectural marvel of Crack de Chevaliers. We lose the very idea that shaped the identity of the West for 1,000 years.
We do. And maybe what we gain is a world with a little less fanaticism. A world where change happens at a human pace, through trade and diplomacy, not at the point of a sword. It's a quieter world. And I can't help but feel, after all this, that the great tragedy of our own timeline is that it took a holy war to get us to truly look at each other. The butterfly effect of history reminds us that the world we know today is just one of countless possibilities shaped by moments of chance, choice, and consequence that could have easily gone another way. This has been Historical What Ifs, where every episode reveals how fragile our timeline really is and how different decisions by our ancestors might have created an entirely different present. Understanding these alternate possibilities doesn't just satisfy our curiosity. It helps us appreciate how remarkable it is that we ended up in this particular version of history.